This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Daniel Paris, host of New Books in Finance, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm delighted to have as my guest today, J.C. DeSwan, the author of just published Seeking Virtue in Finance, Contributing to Society in a Conflicted Industry, a book that just came out with Cambridge. J.C. DeSwan is a partner at a New York investment firm, and he also teaches at Princeton. J.C., thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the title of your book is ambitious, Seeking Virtue in Finance. Most people, even listeners of New Books in Finance, might be taken a little bit aback by that. That's great. That's why I'm delighted to have you on the show. Tell me what led you to such an ambitious topic.
Sure. So as you mentioned, I divide my time between teaching and working as an investment professional. And my initial angle into the investment industry was really through the conceptual lens of public policy and economic development, because that's what I studied as a graduate student. And I was particularly interested in this idea of finance as a tool for development and as a way to foster prosperity. And I eventually started teaching about 12 years ago at Princeton, and created a couple courses, and one in particular that was meant to address all of these issues. And what I found repeatedly over the years is that many of my students are keen to work in finance, but they're concerned about being corrupted the minute they walk into their first job on Wall Street. And so I created this course on ethics and finance. And halfway through the first semester I taught it, one student asked me, why is it that it's almost always the case that we talk about unethical behavior? Why don't we talk about praiseworthy decisions and inspiring people? And I thought, of course, she was completely right. And so I looked for literature on role models in the industry, and I couldn't find it. So I decided to write the book. And my approach was to set out to identify remarkable individuals who essentially counter the narrative of badly behaving, self-serving finance professionals. But to be clear, what I looked for were not people that were altruistic in any way, but people that were self-interested, ambitious, often successful, each in their own way, but who managed to balance their self-interest with the collective interest despite the very significant pressure to conform to industry norms. And from that study, so I spent a few years researching and interviewing a lot of people in the industry, and I ended up focusing on about 60 individuals and firms. And what I did was to tease out patterns of what virtuous behavior in finance might look like and what the pillars of a virtuous career might be.
And I should let the audience know that the book is not very long. It is filled with these vignettes about individuals who are both self-interested, but also not so self-interested to the extent of other virtues that you're trying to achieve. So it is very readable, a combination of kind of mini biographies, as well as the structure. As you said, you want to kind of highlight how you boil down these 60 stories into four types of behavior that you think are achievable despite the, as you put it, a conflicted industry. And that's putting it mildly.
Sure. And so out of the study of these individuals and these firms, I teased out essentially a framework that has four pillars of what would be virtuous behavior in the industry. And the first pillar is really about serving your client with your client's interest in mind. So faithfully serving your client, even when no one is looking. And of course, it's often the case that no one is looking in finance because finance tends to be complicated and opaque and so on. So that's the first one. And I would argue that's the most important one in the hierarchy because that's your professional mandate. In finance, we serve clients, we're intermediaries. And so that should be the most important. The second pillar is the one that I think warrants more attention in the industry. Because we often don't think about it. And it's this idea that, and in some ways, I think of it as a conundrum in the sense that you can serve your customers well and fulfill your primary mandate, customer mandate. And in serving them well, you will do well for yourself. But you could serve them well by extracting value from others. And it could be other stakeholders. It could be any of several types of stakeholders, and so that's an important one that I think needs more attention.
That is a zero sum game versus not a zero sum game.
Yes, exactly. Social creation.
Yes. And the assumption is that most people, most of the time, for better or for worse, and probably for worse, are engaged in a zero-sum activity. You're pointing out that that's not obligatory, that there are win-wins. They may be harder to find, but there are opportunities in finance to create
yes.
social wealth.
Yes. And in fact, I'm not sure I would put it that harshly in the sense that I would guess that most of the industry is actually creating value for society as a whole. And it's actually an important point here is that my underlying premise here and my fundamental belief is that finance is a force for good. And, it's central to the way an economy works. It has many indirect positive effects on the economy. And there's been an enormous amount of research since the 1990s showing that. But it's also the case that because of a combination of structural changes that have taken place on Wall Street since the early 70s and subsequent behavioral changes, the industry appears to have swayed away from its client-serving mission and its singular focus on supporting the real economy.
I want to get away from the big picture to one specific
thing,
because you came upon something very specific there, which I think I understand, or I'm going to go there. And it's almost a technical detail, but people won't think about it. It's really important. And I assume what you're referring to in the 1970s is the end of partnerships in favor of publicly traded
yes.
entities. And that while that is now the norm, the rush to be publicly traded among professional service corporations, which is how I view whether it's an investment bank or consulting firms and so forth, accounting firms, that when they were partnerships, and very few people under a certain age remember when all of the accounting firms and professional service firms and consulting firms and investment banks were just partnerships, that apparently they were very different entities than they have become now. And I think that's worth going down that rabbit hole a little bit, because I think most listeners
sure.
have not thought about that.
Yes, I mean, the first bank, DLJ, decided to go public in the early 1970s. And little by little, most of the large investment banks ended up going public, with Goldman Sachs doing so in 1998. And it changed the dynamics profoundly on Wall Street. And of course, if you're a partnership, your entire wealth is on the line. And as a result, you end up behaving more conservatively because it's essentially your money that you're putting
at risk. We should explain that again for certain people who the nature of a partnership as opposed to sort of an LLC. In an LLC, you set it so that you have liability up to the amount of the money that you put into a business, but no more than that. And the LLC can fail and there's no claim against your personal assets. In a partnership, that is not the case. And partners at businesses are often called upon to put extra money into the business in difficult times, and in theory, it's limitless. And that apparently, I'm putting words in your mouth, correct me if I'm wrong, makes the partners behave in a different manner than they might otherwise, and a better manner is what I'm concluding from your the way you position that.
Yes, and there are fascinating studies that show the impact on CEO behavior. And you see like perhaps the most significant change is just the amount of leverage that banks have had over the years. You see the leverage going up dramatically over the next 20, 30 years. And you also see CEO compensation going up dramatically as their compensation is tied to the share price. But where the biggest challenge ends up being the fact that there's an inherent conflict of interest, and it's one that of course we can live with and that we've learned to live with, but in an environment where there is so much pressure to perform from shareholders if you're publicly listed and you are coming out with your earnings and your financial performance on a quarterly basis. And there's tension between that pressure to perform on a quarterly basis and the long-term solicitous handling of customer relationships that is the hallmark of longer-term businesses and client businesses. And that's where you've seen a lot of friction in these banks over the years. And it certainly, I think, created some of the problems that we've seen in recent years, whether it's through the increased leverage or through the shorter term horizons that these banks have had to have by default.
So is it a conflict of interest or is it just an agency cost? If I want to invest in a company and I did not create the company and I do not have the resources to buy the company outright, I have to acknowledge that I'm going to face an agency cost. I buy shares of the company. I vote for the directors. The directors appoint the CEO. The CEO appoints the executives, and the executives manage the business. And I realistically have to acknowledge that there are agency costs at every point along there. It's an imperfect system. But if I want to have an ownership stake in said business, I have to deal with it. And that is the beauty of the public market. So I'm more at peace perhaps with the fact that in order to get access to certain types of companies that I did not create and cannot buy in their entirety, I have to put up with a lot of a lot of potential problems.
Yeah. And the point is that it's not something that we should bemoan. It's more of a fact that we should be aware of and try to address. But I don't think anyone would argue that these companies should go back to becoming partnerships. And there are valid reasons why this decided to list publicly. But the thing is, it's really hard to get that balance right of how to compensate the agents and how to ensure that the agents work for the good of the shareholders and all stakeholders in a way that doesn't create problems by you know, in having them entirely focused on short-term performance, for instance.
As the audience will know, I work in investments as well and have written in the past on short-termism, and quarterly reporting is a sort of a disaster. But we're not here to discuss that today, nor can we change it immediately. I want to make sure we hit the highlights, though, of your framework. Customers first is the first point. Social wealth creation, we hit. The third and the fourth, humanistic leadership and engaged citizenship.
Yeah.
Do you want to say a word or two?
Sure. And so the third one in the hierarchy is lower because now we're looking inside the organization. And it occurred to me as I was interviewing all these remarkable individuals that it's also important to think of not only your customers, not only all the other stakeholders, but also your colleagues and your employees. And so this is about treating your employees and your colleagues with dignity and also preventing discrimination. And so that also includes promoting diversity in your firm and in the industry. So that's the third pillar. And then the fourth pillar, which is in some ways to me is almost the most interesting because that's where you can find really fascinating stories, is this idea that finance provides you a skill set that ends up being very, very versatile. And there are lots of ways for finance professionals to take advantage of their skill set, to take advantage of the networks that they've created to help society outside of their jobs. And sometimes it's in parallel to their jobs. Sometimes it's after they leave their jobs in the finance industry. And so I wanted to explore specifically how they did that to broaden the definition of how a finance professional could be virtuous by also showing that it's not just what they do on the job, but it's also what they do outside of the job with what they've taken and learned from the finance industry.
And you characterize this as engaged citizenship as
yes.
kind of the title for that.
Yes.
And so you have these, you know, having all these discussions and distilled what is the, I wouldn't say the ideal, but an ideal form of behavior. You do then bring together a number of stories and examples and of how these can play out, customer first, social wealth creation, humanistic leadership, engaged citizenship. And there are many vignettes. They're quite interesting. You want to, you know, tease the audience with a couple in each of those four points that
sure.
drive what customers first and the other points look like in practice.
Sure. Yeah. So there are a lot of them, but let me mention, for instance, I mean, the first pillar is serving your customers faithfully. I was particularly interested in finding folks in the investment industry, in large part because that's where I am. And also, frankly, I approached this with a lot of humility, and it was a lot of this project was also for me to learn and understand this, and not just for my students and for potential readers. So I was keen to find examples in the hedge fund industry. And what was fascinating about it is it was incredibly hard to find. I remember sitting down with the heads of two of the largest prime brokerage departments in New York and asking them, who is a fiduciary leader in the industry? And they drew complete blanks. And it was interesting because I could tell they were keen to come up with names and that they wanted to follow up. And it was just like they couldn't come up with any name. And I found this guy who coincidentally turns out to be located in Princeton, but complete coincidence. And I had him come to talk in my class some like 8 years ago. And I thought he was very interesting. He's a trader that came out of a legendary fixed income arbitrage group at Salomon Brothers in the 1980s. But he wasn't comfortable with the culture. It was a very sharp-elbowed culture, as it's, you know, it's been very well documented. And so he left, and he and his partner, who was also in that group, so Andy Okun and Stephen Modzelewski, they went out to create their own hedge fund. But what's interesting about their approach is that typically when you create a hedge fund, you go to one of the main law firms that create terms for that creates, you know, they create the main documents, the PPM and so on. And there are boilerplate terms that, you know, frankly, typically skew more, you know, in favor of the fund manager. And these guys said, we're not going to do that. So they wrote their terms on a blank sheet of paper, thinking about what would be reasonable, thoughtful terms to have. And now, of course, eventually they had lawyers go over them, but they set up their hedge fund in a way that is unusual in the sense that for the big things, they're skewed. I mean, they're certainly like very customer friendly, and the big things end up being, you know, they have low management fees and they have incentive fees that are aligned and they have all sorts of things. But what's most interesting to me is that the fine print tends to be biased in favor of their clients in ways that, frankly, the clients may not even be so aware of or may not even care that much. But for them, it's a question of principle. And they did one thing that was fascinating to me and that, frankly, I haven't seen anywhere else in the industry in the hedge fund side. I've seen this amongst mutual funds, but this idea of what's often referred to as fulcrum fee, where, you know, so they keep a portion of their of the profits every year if they make gains. But if they made losses, they would actually return part of the losses from their own savings to their clients. And I thought that was fascinating. And that was, you know, that's brave. It seems right because it's only symmetrical. And they did it for 20 years. And then there was a change in the tax code that prevented them from doing that. But this is an example in the hedge fund industry, and there are all sorts of other anecdotes around them that suggest that they care about this. They don't do this for marketing, and in fact, it took me 5 years to convince them to allow me to write about him because he's very self-effacing and discreet. So that's an example. You know, I write about other folks like Jack Bogle, of course, and it's impossible not to write about Jack Bogle when you're talking about customer service and delivering value to the customers. And in some ways, Jack Bogle had the enormous privilege of getting to know because he was in some ways an anchor to the seminar, the ethics and finance seminar for 7 years. He came and participated, and he towers above just about anyone else in terms of the impact of the work that he's done. And the only challenge with him in some ways is that it's hard to emulate him because his impact has been so great. And also, frankly, because he's a little different. I mean, he set up his firm as a mutual, as a not-for-profit, and that's, you know, and in some ways that's very extreme.
Not everyone will know, most will know, but just for the minority that might not, Jack Bogle is the founder of Vanguard, passed away maybe 2 or 3 years ago. Yes. Having created Vanguard. You do have an anecdote at the end of that section about a whistleblower who, at great personal risk, informed the government of some shenanigans, but then declined to accept the yes. whole nature of a whistleblower to incentivize people to come forward, but the incentive is monetary. And tell that story, because that is counter to what one would normally expect, even in the moral framework set up by the legislation. Yeah. They did not foresee somebody reacting negatively to the incentive to the whole system. That's I think, a telling story.
Yes. And so I explored the group of whistleblowers on Wall Street as an extreme version of virtue in finance. And in some ways, they're almost in a category of their own relative to any other role models in the book, simply because they're the only ones where you could look at them and say, that's, you know, what they did is could be described as heroic in some instances, simply because in order to address some fundamental issue that was taking place at their firm, they were willing to put their, not only their job, but their livelihood and reputation on the line. And it's well known that whistleblowers typically lose their jobs, but also are essentially unemployable after they do this. And so I have an enormous amount of respect for them. Now, after the global financial crisis and Dodd-Frank, the SEC created a new program which allows whistleblowers to share in some of the fines that the SEC might get from a firm that's been caught and that's been proven to have acted fraudulently. And so, of course, I mean, it creates a lot of incentives for whistleblowers to come forth. And now when you're looking at it purely from a moral perspective, it becomes a little harder to tell the story because you don't know. Like, you don't know for sure to what extent they were driven by really wanting to address the fraud versus there was an enormous incentive because in a lot of these instances, they're making millions and millions of dollars. And I shouldn't overstate it because it's not like there are that many that have benefited from it, but it's still, there's this enormous incentive that could allow them to make a lot more money than they would have in the normal course of their careers. Eric Benarzi is different. And I was absolutely fascinated by his case because he's someone that transferred to Deutsche Bank, I think in the early 2010s. And he found that they were mismarking internally some of their derivatives and had done so for some time in a way that was well understood by them. And he tried to address this internally, was not able to. He escalated it. And eventually it took a turn for the worse and he left and he brought the SEC in. And eventually the SEC found that that Deutsche Bank was guilty and they charged them for millions and millions of dollars. And he ended up being eligible
under the terms of the prosecution, under the terms of the legislation.
Exactly. Like he was eligible for multiple millions of dollars. And I think by the time this came about, if you had separated the amount that was going to go to his estranged wife, it was about $3.5 million going to him. And he decided to turn it down. And he thought it wasn't right because this was money that was really shareholders' capital. And it was really a question of principle. Now, when you look at this, you're skeptical, right? There's got to be something else going on because, certainly, I mean, my focus in the book is about folks who did not grab what they could when they could. But this is more extreme. This is really money that was given to him and that he really actively refused. And so, you know, I was wondering to what extent, like, is this someone who is wealthy enough that this would make a difference? And all the indications are not. That's not the case. And that, in fact, he had to withdraw his kids from private schools at some point after he lost his job, and he had some challenges, I think, and finding a new job, and he moved to Israel. So he's the real deal, and I thought it was remarkable to find people like this, and just because it's so unusual.
Yeah, and again, each of your stories and each of the categories really is running up against the assumption in classical economics, University of Chicago School, not to name names, but let's name names, profit maximization and shareholder maximization and profit maximization. And what's interesting, I think, for the readers will be that there are so many of these stories, whether it's customers first or the other categories, that this is not an uncommon, it's not an everyday occurrence, but it is not an uncommon occurrence where you run into people who are willing to really define profit maximization in a somewhat different, broader term. In social wealth creation, do you want to call out one or two best examples?
Yeah, and maybe let me illustrate a bad example of this to make clear what I'm talking about here. And I think an extreme example of serving your customer well, but by extracting value from other stakeholders, is the example of JP Morgan in the 90s or Goldman Sachs in the early 2000s, where JP Morgan was serving the government of Italy and helping them obfuscate their level of debt or the level of sovereign debt that they were reporting to the European Union. And Goldman Sachs did something similar with Greece. And so this is an example of a situation where both JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs would have been paid a lot of money for good reasons, in a sense, because this is exactly why you would hire ultra sophisticated firms like Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan, because they have this very unique skill set that allows them to have incredible insight. Well, first, I mean, the finance skills to be able to see through this, but also like the insights to really understand how regulations work and the inner workings of EU guidelines and so on. And they successfully were able to obfuscate the level of debt. Now, when you step back, however, it's hard to not see this as a situation where they did this by extracting value from the rest of society, because now they've allowed this to go unnoticed. And of course, we know, you know, down the road, we had the Eurozone crisis in 2011, 2012, because of tremendous levels of debt, sovereign debt that were unsustainable. Of course, that's not, you know, I don't want to ascribe the blame on these banks, but it's an example.
Go ahead, feel free. The rest of us do it anyhow.
and also, Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan are proxies for all the other banks. And I don't mean to focus on them, but that would be the example. So now, on the other side, you have all sorts of people that are going the other way, and I write about Frederick Samama, who I've actually known very well for the last 15, 20 years. And he has been a manager at Amundi, which is now the largest asset manager in Europe. And sometime in the mid to late 2000s, he had a view that the forces of commercial finance could be deployed to both service clients and help address climate change. And at a time when it was not a particularly hot topic. And so he started convening almost on his own long-term investors and academics to start thinking about like, what are the tools that we could use? How can we use these commercial forces in the right direction? And eventually this led to him and in partnership with Patrick Bolton, who's an academic at Columbia Business School, to convince the first important pension fund manager who was willing to embed ESG factors in his investments. And that was Mats Andersson, who at that time managed AP4, which is one of the Swedish pension funds. And eventually that paved the way. So they were one of the pioneers for the development of what is now an enormous trend towards embedding ESG factors in investments. And what was interesting to me is that you could look at this in hindsight as well, you know, maybe this was just a commercial interest, but the reality is being very close to him when it happened, it was completely unfashionable to go in that direction back then. And in fact, it was at that time, I think I certainly saw it as a career limiting move, but yet he persevered and ended up being one of the many pioneers in what is now like an enormous trend for the good, I think.
So the ESG is everywhere. I, as an asset manager myself, I'm just overwhelmed with the amount of information I'm presented with and expectations. Appreciating what the first mover might have done, I have to say the pendulum has swung in the other direction now. There's very few emails or conversations which now aren't about ESG. the pendulum may have gone a little bit too far, but it'll settle over time.
Yeah, and I think it's reasonable to ask whether it's going too fast and whether we're in an ESG bubble at this stage.
Yeah, I'm not supposed to say that, but I'm glad you did. One of the most interesting and sort of personal chapters is on humanistic leadership, because it's about individuals within the firms taking we'll call it the McKinsey view, though that's also a multifaceted term with many meanings. And also, you know, again, the pendulum has swung from Goldman Sachs having a certain type of leadership to Goldman Sachs having a reputation for a different type of personnel. But prior to, or when Goldman Sachs was a partnership, it had some extremely interesting people, and you write about them, and they read as if they're coming out of a history book, because one wonders how many people like them are, you know, operating today. And you've highlighted them, but you know, it's hard to live up to the standards of these almost Frank Capra, Jimmy Stewart like figures running the local bank in It's a Wonderful Life. I don't see too many people like that, except in Frank Capra movies.
Yeah, no, you're right. And I think there were many of them. The one I ended up focusing on the most is John Whitehead, who was the co-senior partner at Goldman Sachs from the mid-1970s to the mid-1980s. And I also had the enormous privilege of getting to know him. He was pretty involved in the seminar for about 3 years before he passed away. He was really in some ways, he identified with Goldman Sachs's culture and values, and he is the one who wrote the initial 12 business principles that over time, I think, became 14 business principles. But with the first one being, you should always serve your customers' interests or prioritize your customers' interests. And they really believed it based on all my interviews with him and other folks from that era. And what's interesting is to look at specific decisions that they made at the time that would have come across as uncommercial. And you know, they were uncommercial in the short term. They were, you could look at them and also make the argument that they were very commercial if you had a very long-term view.
I believe one of the phrases, and I forget whose it is, but long-term, extremely greedy. But you have to pause and think about that. In order to be successfully greedy long-term, it's very, very different, almost diametrically opposed to being successfully greedy short-term. But you have to think about that first.
Yeah. And it, you know, one of the fascinating civil wars that took place at Goldman Sachs, and I've never worked there, but I've certainly interviewed a lot of people that have, and there's been an enormous amount written about them, was the agonizing, I think, internal debates that they had as to whether they should go public or not. And there were multiple votes that were taken where they turned down that option, the partnership turned down that option, until eventually they decided to go public in 1998. John Whitehead was one of the people that resisted that. But again, you know, the reality is that it would have been hard. And I think he was very mindful of the fact that ultimately, if they were going to try to remain the preeminent global investment bank, or a preeminent global investment banks, in order to compete, they needed the capital and had to go public.
Yeah, it's probably worth mentioning what you just said from a technical perspective, that the partnership structure, in addition to having different liability perspectives or framework, but a publicly traded company just has a much easier time to raise money to grow their business than a partnership. A partnership requires the partners to put in additional capital if they want to buy something or engage in a new project, whereas for publicly traded companies, the mechanisms of additional shares, share prices going up, et cetera, makes it much easier for the companies to raise capital to expand. And as you point out, the competitive dynamic when the other investment bank, former partnership, but now an investment bank that's publicly traded, has access to much more capital than you do, it's going to be harder to keep up with them. So that's why this, you know, the shift occurred, kind of the relentless growth. But it just, again, so that people understand the difference between a partnership and a publicly traded entity.
Yeah. And you know, once your competitor goes public, it's very, very hard to make the decision not to. And there are very few firms that have made that decision. You know, I mean, I can think of only a few, like Brown Brothers Harriman is one of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in the humanistic leadership category, there are some other examples. It's not just John Whitehead, but also the structural way that McKinsey operates its partnership. It is not publicly traded. And the real focus on human resources and human capital that company has, and clearly you link it to their success. And there are many other stories about that. But in effect, you know, investing your people, and finally, and third, investing your people is one of the clear conclusions. And then those people who are successful, shall we say, on Wall Street, you want to highlight they go beyond Wall Street and are engaged in activities outside of Wall Street citizenship that is worth noting. It doesn't involve a lot of golf clubs and fancy things. There are people out there trying to make the world a better place, having accumulated significant capital on Wall Street. And so there are interesting stories there as well.
Yes. And, you know, John Whitehead is a perfect example of someone that left Goldman Sachs to become first undersecretary of state. And had an incredible career as a public servant. He ended up chairing so many not-for-profit organizations. He was the head of the 9/11 commission. And so had an incredible career after this. But I think what's interesting is that it's not only that model that you can find, right? It's not only, I also write about Robert Lovett, who was one of the partners at Brown Brothers Harriman back when Brown Brothers Harriman was the preeminent firm and went on to become a very distinguished public servant under FDR. But there's also the model of Erin Goddard. Erin is, I met her, or I connected with her. She was 28. She had been an accountant at Ernst & Young in Toronto. And after 5 years, took a summer off to go to Rwanda to volunteer. And she came back from Rwanda with this insight that in a developing economy, the lack of accounting skill has just profound implications on the productivity of their corporate sector, because so they have a staggeringly low number of CPAs and accountants. And the net result of that is that many of their firms and not-for-profits are run in a loosey-goosey way, because nobody really knows what the numbers are. And so she thought, well, this is a place where I can make a real difference. And so she went back and she created an accounting institute. And it took some years to get it right. But eventually she and one of her partners, actually from her colleagues from EY in Toronto, went there and they lived there. And now it's at the point where, and so this has been running for 4 years or so, and she has cohorts of 100 students who are on a 4-month program that makes them job ready as accountants. And in doing so, she addresses two things. One is she enables the development of a skill set that is incredibly helpful. I mean, the impact that skill set has is probably disproportionate. And secondly, she's also creating a path towards middle class for a subset of students. And so I thought her profile was very interesting, because it's the opposite of John Whitehead, right? Mm-hmm. It's and there are a lot of examples in between, but I found what I thought were really interesting stories of ways in which finance professionals use their skill set for the collective interest outside of their main occupation.
So having done this, having taught at Princeton for 12 years, having distilled these investigations and conversations down into four pretty absorbable categories with nicely told stories, the question I have to ask is, how successful has it been? What has been the impact of trying to communicate this to undergraduates and graduate students? And when many of them, I'm prepared to assert, are come into your class substantially with the goal of profit maximization, near-term profit maximization, and keen on getting to Goldman Sachs and as quickly as possible, that you've taken on quite a big challenge now that you've distilled this into a book. But what has been the takeaway with your effort? I'm not going to say single-handedly, but your effort to persuade the students going in, hey, pause, think, consider how you're approaching this endeavor. Have you had enough time and examples of your students to come back to you and say, hey, that made sense, or no, that just doesn't survive the first week of training at Goldman Sachs?
Yes. Well, I mean, a few things. One is my students tend to be self-selected because it's a course in the ethics and finance.
And, so it's an elective, effectively?
It's an elective. And so I think a lot of my students are interested in finance and in having positive impacts in society. So there's a predisposition there. But now, this being said, my assumption is that the younger generation is actually more predisposed to have that approach. And I may be wrong because I realize I have biased sample, and but also based on what I read and what I see as an investment professional, my sense is that younger generation is more predisposed to it. And I think it's because they were formed by the global financial crisis. And my sense is that if, you know, in the 90s and the 2000s, a lot of our perspective on finance was that finance is a force for good and more finance is better. And in fact, when you look at the academic research starting in the early 1990s, a lot of it in that field was about trying to understand the positive spillover effects of finance on the economy and society. And that was great. And frankly, that's one of the reasons that drew me to finance, was to try to understand this better and to try to implement that. But I think after the global financial crisis, there's been a lot of soul searching, because of course, this notion that more finance is better seemed to have been shattered. And now there's this sense of, well, maybe that's not the case. And maybe we need to be more thoughtful about how to work in finance and how to use finance. And for sure, finance is a force for good, but not all finance is a force for good. And there are ways in which its impact on society can be mitigated and improved. And so I've been generally positively, I wouldn't say surprised, but I see my students. I generally stay in touch with my students over the years, and I typically do Zoom sessions with them every year and invite them to come back. And a lot of them seem very thoughtful, whether it's from this class or I teach another class on Asian capital markets and economies and capital markets that has nothing to do with ethics. But I do feel that this new generation is a little different. And I hope I'm right. And this book is meant to provide, it's meant to be a very modest contribution to the debate and help them provide a little bit of guidance as to what it would look like to be virtuous, but being completely realistic about the fact that behavior is primarily driven by incentives, and also the fact that that in and of itself doesn't create a comprehensive solution to the issues that we face as an industry. It's only part of the solution. And its premise is that a lot of people in finance are well-meaning, but not particularly aware of their impact.
Well, this we can take as a kind of a step in the right direction, a partial step, partial solution for that problem for an industry that we all have to acknowledge has a bad rap. But again, one step at a time to rectifying that, one person at a time, and that's to some extent what your work is doing, is showing that, you know, these individuals have made a difference, and if you gather them together in a coherent narrative, it may well and hopefully will be compelling to people entering the profession and people already in the profession. JC DeSwan, thank you so much for being on the show. The book is Seeking Virtue in Finance, Contributing to Society in a Conflicted Industry. It just came out from Cambridge University Press. I encourage not only students of finance, but practitioners to take a look at it and pause and think about it. It is a refreshing take on, indeed, a conflicted industry. JC, thank you so much again for being on the show.
Great. Thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed this.